Ladies and gentlemen, I shall begin by reading a letter. It was written by a young man to his mother. As you listen to it, I'd like you to observe and to evaluate the thinking processes that this letter reflects. Quote, "Dear Mother, today I am feeling better than yesterday. I really don't feel much like writing, but I love to write to you. After all, I can tackle it twice. Yesterday, Sunday, I would have been so happy if you and Louise and I could have gone to the park. One has such a lovely view from Stefan's castle. Actually, it's very lovely in Bergoselli. Louise wrote Bergoselli on her last two letters. I mean to say on the envelopes. No, the couverts which I received. However, I have written Bergoselli in the spot where I put the date. There are also people in Bergoselli who call it Holzleberg. Others talk of a factory. I'm writing on paper. The pen which I'm using is from a factory called Perry and Company. This factory is in England. I assume this. Behind the name of Perry Company, the city of London is inscribed, but not the city. The city of London is in England. I know this from my school days. Then I always liked geography. My last teacher in that subject was Professor August A. He was a man with black eyes. I also like black eyes. There are also blue and gray eyes and other sorts, too. I've heard it said that snakes have green eyes. All people have eyes. There are some, too, who are blind. These blind people are led about by a boy. It must be very terrible not to be able to see. There are people who can't see, and in addition can't hear. I know some who hear too much. One can hear too much. There are many sick people in Bergoselli. One of them I like a great deal. He taught me that in Bergoselli there are many kinds. Then there are some who are not here at all. They're all peculiar people." Unquote. Now you will all immediately grasp that this letter is not the product of a rational thinking process. But identify why and how you know this. What did you observe about the letter that led you to this conclusion? What you observed was this, that the various thoughts that compose the letter are not linked or logically connected by any central theme. The writer wanders mentally. His ideas ramble without any intelligible progression. Each sentence is connected to the next by some chance association, not by a logical connection. The total is a grab bag of separate, unrelated thoughts. And although each separate sentence is formally grammatical and does convey a meaning, the sentences lead nowhere, and the total has no meaning. What the letter crucially lacks is the unifying, integrating factor of purpose. The writer of this letter is a catatonic schizophrenic. I was quoting from Eugene Bleuler's famous monograph on schizophrenia, Dementia Praecox. The letter was presented as an example of schizophrenic thinking. A major symptom of schizophrenia is the deterioration of the thinking process, a deterioration that's made manifest in the schizophrenic's inability to hold to a single purpose and to unify and integrate his thoughts around that purpose in a logical progression. Thinking, in the literal and rational meaning of the word, is a purposeful mental activity, having knowledge of reality as its goal. Whether it be a child's first attempt to grasp the difference between a dog and a cat, or an abstract philosopher's attempt to define the fundamental nature of reality, it's the presence of a purpose that crucially distinguishes a rational process of thought from the lunatic ramblings of a schizophrenic. Wherever there is thought, there is purpose, a purpose setting and directing every step of the thinking activity. But just as a focus must be volitionally set and maintained, so a purpose must be volitionally set and maintained. In order to think, a mind must choose and then hold to its mental goal, that is, the problem to be solved or the concept to be grasped. This will not happen automatically. It requires an act of mental decision. It requires self-consciousness, an awareness of what one's mind is doing, and direction and control of what one's mind is doing. Now, certainly most people's minds don't function quite like the schizophrenic who wrote the letter I quoted. But neither are most people purposeful and self-conscious about the activities of their minds. And as a result, the mental processes of people who would consider themselves rational and intelligent are too often frighteningly similar to those of the schizophrenic writer. The difference, as I'll demonstrate, is one of degree. Everyone recognizes that a child isn't born knowing how to talk, to walk, to read, to write, that he must learn how to do these things. But everyone assumes that somehow a child and an adult does automatically know how to think. Everyone assumes that thinking is in effect an instinct, something that one just knows how to do, and that no process of study or learning is required. Well, if you believe this, check your premises. If you were to stop a dozen people at random, give them a problem to think about, and later ask them to report on what their minds had proceeded to do in order to solve the problem, you would discover that they had engaged in quite different kinds of mental activity, but all of them called their mental activity thinking. You would discover that when people use the word thinking, they very often use it to name quite different kinds of mental activities, some of which are effective in gaining knowledge, some of which are grossly ineffective. People customarily take their own mental processes as self-evidently valid, as not to be questioned. They don't seek to correct or improve faulty methods of thinking because it doesn't even occur to them to consider their methods of thinking. As a result, inefficient methods, once initiated, harden into habits, which are then practiced automatically. And one's thinking processes continue to deteriorate, and one is less and less able to solve problems, less and less able to deal with reality, and to direct one's life intelligently. And those who have never properly learned to think are, of course, always the quickest to conclude that the mind is impotent, that thinking is not the means to acquire knowledge. They do not question the nature of their own mental processes. They question instead the efficacy of reason. Inefficient methods of thinking are the greatest of all destroyers of intelligence. Whatever a man's potential intellectual capacity, his actual ability to deal with problems can be no better than his method of thinking, no better than his method of using that capacity. The greatest brain on earth could not solve the simplest of problems if he approached it by the method of the schizophrenic letter writer. You have all heard the saying, whom the gods would destroy, they first make mad. If you look at the manner in which most men run their lives, you will conclude that it's more accurate to say, whom the gods would destroy, they first make stupid. But this stupidity is not the result of a deficient brain. It's a self-made stupidity, a stupidity that is the inexorable result of inefficient thinking processes. A high intellectual capacity is only a potential, which its possessor must learn how to use. Let me give you an illustration. A young man is about to enter college, and he's attempting to decide whether to enroll in College A or College B. He goes to his room for the purpose of thinking this problem over. Now here we'll tune in on his inner mental processes. There's a very good professor with a brilliant reputation at College A, but College B is more convenient to travel to from home. I wonder if Dad will buy me a car. I like the new Thunderbird. The gray and white one I saw was great. Dad's a tightwad. He said he'd get me a car, but he'll probably change his mind. Carol's going to College A, I think. I don't see much of her these days. I wonder who she's been going out with. Oh, yes, the fees at both colleges are the same, so there's really no issue there. I think I'll give Carol a call tonight. Now, I wonder which college has a better selection of courses. That would be important to know. I rather like the Powder Blue Thunderbird, too. They say college is much more difficult than high school. But I'll do all right. I've always been a good student. But how the devil am I going to decide which college to attend? At this point, the boy's father enters the room and asks him what he's been doing. The boy answers that he's been thinking very hard about which college to attend, but somehow he can't seem to decide. Now the question is, has this boy been thinking? The connections between his thoughts were certainly more understandable than those of the schizophrenic. But observe the very significant similarities. Here again, there was no logical relationship between one thought and the next. There was no consistently followed purpose dominating and integrating the sequence of thoughts. The mental process was essentially passive. The boy didn't direct the actions of his mind. Rather, he was simply the observer of associations made by his subconscious. If one may compare the mind to a car, then this boy didn't drive the car. He just went along for the ride. Ask yourselves how often you have engaged in a similar mental process and called it thinking. To the extent that you do so, the difference between that boy and you on the one hand and the schizophrenic on the other is that the boy and you can reassert and reestablish control over the function of your mind by choosing to do so. The schizophrenic cannot. What should the boy have done instead? Well, in essence, his thinking process should have followed a pattern such as this. Why am I going to college? To train myself for my future profession. Then which college, A or B, can, to the best of my knowledge, best further this end? There are three essential criteria. First, the general academic level of the respective colleges. Second, the caliber of the professors in the field I'll be studying. Third, the comprehensiveness of the courses offered in my field at the respective colleges. It seems that the academic level of the two colleges is the same. Both are regarded as of the top rank. Professor R, who teaches at College A, is said to be a brilliant man in his field, and no one has a reputation equal to his at College B. College B, however, offers almost twice as many courses as College A, which means that I could acquire a wider and firmer education there. I think this outweighs the advantage of studying with Professor R. I think, therefore, that I will attend College B. Now, needless to say, the thinking process I just presented is highly simplified, but it does reflect the essence of the right approach, the establishment of a purpose, the asking and answering of relevant questions, and a deduction from one's answers that is consonant with one's original purpose. Now, if it happened that in comparing the three aspects of colleges A and B, he found them to be equal, the boy would then be free to decide which to attend by another and less fundamental standard, such as perhaps which college was more physically convenient to reach from home or which college Carol was attending. But then he would have to know that he was no longer judging by academic or scholastic criteria. And he would have to know why he was justified in acting on some other stand. I have compared the mind to a car. To continue the metaphor, we call the process of active, purposeful thinking front seat driving, and we call passive, associational thinking back seat driving. Let me explain why. Consider what one does when one is the driver of a car, sitting behind the wheel and heading toward a chosen destination. The front seat driver first must know exactly where he intends to go. Then he must direct the motion of the car toward his chosen goal by the shortest and most efficient route. He must, as he drives, watch constantly for road signs, signs that will tell him that he's proceeding in the right direction. He must constantly be in total control of what's occurring. He must deliberately choose and direct each step of his progression. Now, consider in contradistinction to this what one does when one is the passenger of a car, just along for the ride, when one is a backseat driver. The backseat driver has no purpose in the sense of a destination that he has assumed the responsibility of reaching. He's passive with regard to the final goal of the car. He's simply being carried along and is neither initiating nor influencing the motion and direction of the car. He sits passively, observing whatever scenery the car may happen to pass, ending up wherever the car may happen to stop. The scenery he sees is the scenery that rolls by his window, and he is only its passive contemplator. In the same way, the backseat driver of thought doesn't choose a final goal, a destination, a purpose to his mental activity. He is mentally carried along passively. He doesn't direct the progression of his thought. He merely observes whatever his subconscious feeds him by chance association. And the conclusion or decision, if any, which he finally reaches in his thinking, is determined not by facts, not by logic, but by whatever random ideas, memories, emotions, and images happen to lead him. The first attribute, then, of efficient, rational thinking is that it be purposeful, that it be goal-directed. The thinker must consciously, deliberately choose his purpose, that is, choose the problem to be solved, the question to be answered. Now, once that purpose is chosen and is clearly defined, the means of holding to it and never deviating from it is to set oneself sub-purposes, which means to raise and to answer relevant questions. Here again, the analogy of a front seat driver of a car will be useful. The front seat driver heading for a specific destination in Connecticut must know that there are certain signs along the way, signs indicating turns and highways and street names, that will tell him that he's moving toward, not away from, his ultimate goal. In the same manner, the front seat driver of thought must know the markers along his mental road. He must know the questions that have to be asked and answered, the sub-problems that must be solved along the way to his ultimate goal. The boy in the second and rational example of thinking which I gave you first defined his problem to decide between two colleges. Then he defined three sub-problems that had to be solved before he could find the answer. The academic level of the two colleges, the caliber of the professors, and the comprehensiveness of the courses offered. He knew that these were the three questions that had to be asked and answered in order for him to know which college to attend. It is this process of question asking and answering, the setting up of sub-problems, which keeps one's main purpose functioning as a mental directing agent. Either the asking of the right questions will give you the answer, if you already possess the necessary knowledge in your subconscious, or the questions will tell you what you have to find out. You will remember that in the second lecture of this course, Mr. Brandon discussed the nature and function of the subconscious. He explained that the subconscious is the sum of all of one's perceptions, identifications, associations, and conclusions on which the mind is not presently and actively focused. And he described the nature of the relationship between the subconscious storehouse and the presence of a goal or purpose held in the conscious mind as follows, and I quote, "It is the goal or purpose a mind has set in any given instance that determines what material out of the total content of the mind's knowledge will be fed to it from the subconscious. For instance, if a man chooses to think about a specific issue in economics, to solve the problem of what determines the prices paid for goods, it is the material relevant to that issue that will flow into his conscious awareness. His subconscious will feed him, for his consideration, such knowledge as he possesses about supply, demand, production, consumption, trade, etc. But if a man does not clearly know what it is that he wants to know, if he does not have a clearly defined purpose, a clearly defined problem to solve, if he decides just to think about economics with some vague generalized aim, the knowledge he requires from his subconscious filing system will not be forthcoming. His mind will wander aimlessly among chance bits of knowledge and random connections. He will find himself unable to concentrate and will soon give up the attempt as futile. Like an electronic computer, the subconscious requires exactitude of the orders it receives if it is to function efficiently. And if it is given contradictory orders, it will not function at all. The failure to solve a problem is often caused by the absence of a precise, unequivocal definition of the problem one wishes to solve. A purpose in a mind acts in relation to the subconscious as a standard of selection, without which no thought is possible. When a mind abandons purpose, it abandons thinking. And what drifts through it from the subconscious is determined not by logic, but by association. Unquote. Thus, the failure to define an exact purpose in thinking makes one's stored knowledge unavailable and useless to the conscious mind, just as if one had learned nothing in the past and had stored no knowledge whatever. The boy in the first and irrational example of thinking that I gave you, who attempted to decide between the two colleges in a backseat manner, may have had filed away in his subconscious all of the information he required in order to make a rational decision. But because he was backseat driving, that knowledge was not available to him, and his problem was, for all practical purposes, unsolvable. By his method, he might have made a disastrously wrong choice of colleges, deciding on the whim of the moment or by the pressure of a friend, despite the fact that he possessed both the intelligence and the knowledge which could have permitted him to make the right choice. Now consider another and related type of mental process in which many people commonly engage when they think they are thinking. A kind of backseat driving which is sometimes mistaken for a purposeful thought process. Because in this case, the mind is not wandering aimlessly, although its aim is not, in fact, the solution of a problem. A man comes home from his office one evening, and he greets his wife as usual. He vaguely notices that she seems strained, but he pays little attention to it. Then, suddenly, she explodes with anger, and she tells him that today is their anniversary and that he has ignored it completely. Feeling guilty, the man becomes defensive and angry, and a bitter quarrel ensues. His wife accuses him of not caring for her, of never having cared for her, while he insists that she's foolish to read any significance into his forgetfulness, and that besides, he had serious business problems on his mind. The quarrel mounts in intensity, and finally, the wife goes to her room in tears. The husband is upset, and he decides to think about the quarrel and its causes. He's determined to understand who is right and who is wrong, and to find a way to resolve the disagreement. What he does is something like this. He pictures first the crowded, stuffy subway he took on his way home. He remembers how tired he was, and that he was looking forward to seeing his wife and to forgetting the day's problems. He mentally recreates his arrival home, then his wife's sudden outburst, then his own feeling of guilt. He rehears mentally the accusations she had leveled against him. He remembers and re-experiences his resulting anger. He repeats in his mind the answers he had given to her accusations and what she had then replied. In this manner, he relives the entire progression of the evening, going over every word, every gesture, every expression, every emotion, up to the exit of his wife from the room. Perhaps an hour passes in this manner, at the end of which he is not one iota closer to understanding who is right and who is wrong, or what can be done to effect a reconciliation. He has been engaged in mental activity, but he has not been thinking. His mind hasn't wandered away to unrelated subjects, but he has not been thinking. He has been passively reviewing and re-experiencing past events and his own past emotions. He has not been thinking, he has been stewing. A review is not a process of thought. Running a silent motion picture in one's mind is not a process of thought. Reliving an emotional experience is not a process of thought. Yet the example I have just given is precisely what many people do when they are supposedly thinking. They run precisely this kind of motion picture in their minds. They feel badly, they worry, they sigh, they pace up and down. And then they conclude that despite their best efforts and hardest thinking, they simply cannot solve their problem. Well, what should this man have done instead? What would constitute a process of thinking, of rational mental activity, in a case such as this? First, the man should clearly identify the fact that his problem has two aspects, that two issues are involved: his forgetting of their anniversary and his wife's violent reaction to his forgetting. He might then begin by asking himself if it was right, even considering the pressure of business problems on his mind, to forget their anniversary. He might decide that it wasn't, that objectively his wife did have reason to be offended, that he shouldn't have let his feeling of guilt turn into anger, and that he owes his wife an apology and an explanation. He might then ask himself why his wife had been so quick to assume that he didn't care for her, why she had been so violent in her accusations. Had he given her provocation in the past to make her fear his indifference? Perhaps he decides that he has not been remiss in the past in projecting his feelings for her, that he hasn't given her grounds to be apprehensive about his actual attitude. Perhaps he knows that, as she herself has admitted, she's prone to exaggerate and to be oversensitive. He concludes that she was at fault in drawing the implications she drew from his forgetting. With these conclusions in mind, he can go to his wife, tell her what he has identified, and resolve the quarrel. Now, this is, of course, very much foreshortened. There might be a great many more elements for the man to consider. But in essence, this is the rational approach, the rational method of facing such problems. The clarifying of the nature of the problem to be solved, then the asking and answering of the sub-problems that have to be understood in order for the main problem to be solved. A purposeful, rational, step-by-step, logically unified process of thought. In order to maintain any purposeful process of thought, in order to be a front seat driver, it's necessary, of course, to hold one's mind in full focus. To focus means simply to be aware, to be conscious, to perceive, as opposed to a state of daze of mental fog. The act of focusing the mind is the primary mental act. It's the precondition of purposeful thinking. One cannot think while one is mentally half asleep. But it's important to understand that one's alternative is not between a state of full, clear, sharp mental awareness and a fog-like state of complete daze. There are a great many degrees of mental clarity, a great many degrees of focus in between these two states. Many people spend much of their lives in a state of semi-consciousness. They function as though they were seeing reality from underwater, with a veil blurring their perception. Some people, very few, exist in a state of full mental clarity, of a sharp, luminous awareness. But most shift back and forth in states of awareness which are neither of these two. Let me illustrate just a few of the possible levels of focus. At the very bottom of the scale is the state in which one moves through reality in a passive daze, barely perceiving, making decisions, acting, moving, accepting or rejecting ideas with one's mind and focus turned off in a virtual epistemological coma. A slightly higher level of awareness is that in which one focuses sufficiently to perceive and to be aware, but one makes no effort to pass judgments. The meaning of what one perceives is not identified. One estimates nothing, evaluates nothing, concludes nothing. In such a state, you might, for instance, hear and understand every word that I'm saying tonight, but form absolutely no judgment on the validity of what you're hearing. You don't ask if what I'm saying is true or false, right or wrong. You hear, but you do not estimate. You perceive, but you do not judge. A slightly higher level of focusing is that in which one both grasps and judges, but one makes no new connections, performs no new active thinking. In this state, you might grasp what I'm saying and estimate it, but nothing more. You do not integrate your perceptions and judgments into the rest of your premises. Perhaps some of the points being made here are relevant to problems of yours. But in this state of awareness, your mind won't make the connection. Your mind isn't set to that level of effort. And so, potentially valuable knowledge passes you by. Another level is what may be called selective focusing. In this state, one is aware of a splintered reality, a partial reality, a segmentalized reality, but not the whole. Bits and aspects, but never the total of what one is dealing with. In this state, you might focus now and again on one point or another. Your consciousness comes and goes. It sees one issue and then drifts away. And there is no whole, no sum in your mind. Only the memory of isolated sections and parts, disconnected and unintegrated. Full mental clarity means a state in which one perceives, judges, connects, and integrates the full conceptual meaning of every aspect of that with which one is dealing. One grasps, one judges, one looks for new connections, new applications, new integrations. One assumes the responsibility of full consciousness. Let me illustrate what the state of full focus means in the following way. It's the state of a skilled hunter moving through a jungle. The hunter isn't afraid, but he knows that danger exists and that he must be alert for every sign that will give him warning. As he moves, his senses and mind are fully sharp, fully ready, and set to perceive. He will immediately hear any unusual sound. He'll immediately perceive any unusual sight that might signal danger. If he hears an odd sound, he asks himself whether it's a rustle of grass or the hiss of a snake. He interprets and judges everything, and he does so as carefully and accurately as possible. If he sees something new and unknown to him, he does not shrug and turn away because understanding requires too much effort. He knows too clearly that his life depends upon his power to understand, that his survival depends upon the efficiency with which he uses his mind. This is the state of full focus. But it should not be reserved for one's excursions into the jungle. You need it now and at this moment, and in all the moments of your life. You need it at work, you need it in your apartment, you need it walking down the street, you need it when you select a political candidate or a career. People do not use their consciousness in the same way at all times. They focus to different extents in different situations and on different subjects. Sometimes they front seat drive, sometimes they back seat drive. You have all met people who appear remarkably intelligent when dealing with one issue and remarkably stupid when dealing with another. You've all met people who are brilliant in their professions, who can deal with abstract ideas easily and efficiently, but whose personal lives consist of one unnecessary catastrophe after another. It is not their intelligence that varies, it's their use of it. If you wish to know whether or not you are always in full focus, if you wish to know the standard against which to measure yourselves, project how you would read a legal contract involving large sums of money and long-range commitments, a contract affecting your entire future. In such a case, you would be like the jungle hunter. You would be in full focus. You would study the meaning and implication of every word and clause, and you wouldn't skip the small print merely because it appeared complex and difficult. You would know that it is precisely the small print that required your undivided attention. You're a front seat driver to the extent that this is your normal and constant mode of mental functioning. Nothing less will do. To the extent that this is not your mode of mental functioning, you're living at less than your intellectual capacity. You're endangering and undercutting your happiness, your fulfillment, your self-esteem, your life. It is the small print of reality which, unread, is the destroyer of human lives. Now, you might wish to ask, but what if I'm bored with a certain subject or conversation or person? What if I'm confronted with something that does not interest me? Is it not then legitimate to go out of focus? Well, translated, the meaning of such a question is it not legitimate to make myself unconscious, to dissolve my mind in fog, to become less than an animal? If, for instance, you're trapped into listening to a dull conversation, the solution is not to make the boredom bearable by killing your mind. Focus instead on something else, something which does interest you. But if you must join in the conversation, if it's necessary that you speak, then you have to remain focused on it. Your only alternative is to speak and act without knowing what you're doing. To focus means, in essence, to know what you are doing, to know what you're doing in existence, and to know what you're doing in consciousness. If you're studying philosophy at college and you're told that you must take a course in chemistry which doesn't interest you, the solution is not to attend chemistry classes in a dazed stupor. Since chemistry interests you less than philosophy, then you rationally and validly will read fewer books on the subject, you'll delve into it less deeply, you'll not attempt to do any original work in it. But this doesn't mean that you skim over the books you do read without being conscious of what you're reading. Your premise can legitimately be that you'll learn less, but you will still have to learn what you are learning. You'll still have to know what's being said in class. You will still have to remain conscious. You'll have to be fully as much in focus as when you're studying that which does interest you. What is optional in the life of any man is what he chooses to deal with and to what extent. What is not optional is the mental state in which he deals with whatever concerns him. What is not optional is whether or not he will remain in focus. Are there times when it's proper to give one's mind a rest? Most certainly, if one knows what one is doing. At the end of a busy day, you might come home, fling yourself down on the sofa, empty your mind of any purposeful pursuit, and just float. There's nothing wrong with this, provided you know that you are giving yourself a mental rest. You're in danger only if you don't know the difference between this state and a state of purposeful mental work. To be in focus doesn't mean that one must always be in the pursuit of the solution to a problem. If, for instance, you go to a party, you're not there to solve intellectual problems, but you should be fully as much in focus. All that has changed is the object of your focus. A celebration doesn't mean escape from the responsibility of consciousness. It only means the suspension of productive work. Are there people who need to go out of focus, who need to turn off their consciousness in order to celebrate, in order to feel free to enjoy themselves? Yes, there are. But that is a state of neurosis. These are the people who are running from the knowledge that they have nothing to celebrate, that they have no self-esteem, and that only a self-induced mental stupor can anesthetize their self-loathing. The cardinal tool of thinking done in full focus is language. To illustrate the indispensable role of words as the means by which man retains and symbolizes his abstractions, I'll ask you to try the following experiment. Consider any conviction of yours which you feel confident of your ability to prove, such as the conviction that murder is immoral. Now, and I'm going to give you a moment to do this here, now try to prove this conviction, to prove it in your own minds, but to do so without using any words whatever. From your expressions, I take it that you've observed it cannot be done. There is no way to form or retain your thoughts in consciousness, no way to order them in a logical progression, no way to front seat drive without the use of language. Without language, man cannot sustain a thinking process. People often do attempt, however, to think without language. The result is that they go out of focus. In the place of words, they substitute emotions, images, and memories. But these are not substitutes for clearly formed, verbalized ideas. The conclusion of a syllogism is not reached by the union of an emotion and a mental picture. When people speak to each other, they normally do not intersperse between their sentences picture sketches and reports on their random emotions. If they did attempt such interspersions, they wouldn't be understood. But most people do not treat their own minds with the respect they grant to the minds of others. They assume that for themselves, any chaotic hodgepodge is good enough. Now, of course, there are people who do speak chaotically and incomprehensibly to others, who do mutter inarticulate sounds about their feelings rather than clearly communicate ideas. These are the people who will say, "Oh, I can't explain it, but I know what I mean." The truth is that such people do not know what they mean. They merely feel what they feel they mean. And very often, using words literally, they don't mean anything at all. A fact which they're spared the discomfort of discovering by never attempting to translate their feelings into words. Of course, it sometimes can happen that a man has a thought for which he isn't immediately able to find the words. The thought is the product of some subconscious integration of ideas. The thought may even be valid. But he does not know what that thought is until he can translate it into words. Knowledge, conceptual knowledge, begins only with the employment of language.